hope, done sensibly, is that the incentives that for investment and economic growth will bring in enough growth and therefore tax revenue.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
Good afternoon, everyone. Happy Wednesday, 12:11 now on 720 WGN. John Hanson in for Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. A lot to get to today, including the top toys for the holiday season from an expert. Also talking about gaming, whether it can really be an addiction. I know that's a hot topic amongst people, but there's some science to back it up and a fascinating article in the New York Times. And we're going to talk with the person who wrote it. But we're going to jump off talking about food insecurity. I think we've all talked about food deserts, or at least somewhat aware of it, but really diving into the reasons behind it, why it's important, and things that counties can do and local municipalities can do to try and combat it is something that is a little bit more elusive. Here to break it all down is Angela Odoms-Young, an associate professor of kinesiology and nutrition at UIC's Institute for Health Research and Policy. And Angela, now I'm seeing a PhD at the end of that, so I'll say Dr. Odoms-Young, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm happy to be on.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so I'm looking at the urban.org distributing food insecurities list, and it's really a well-put-together infographic where you can kind of search by county what's going on. But you guys really broke this down, not just where the insecurities lie, but kind of some of the reasons behind them. Walk us through what you guys put together.
So this is a report from the Urban Institute, as you mentioned. They had an advisory committee that I served on. One of the things that the purpose was really to create a dashboard where community organizations and others could go in nationally and take a look at how their county compares to other counties when it comes to food insecurity, as well as other issues like high housing costs that families may face. So really the focus was to understand more about food insecurity as it relates to other issues, but as you mentioned, also propose some solutions that communities could engage in to make sure they lowered the risk of food insecurity in their community.
I guess it's interesting, this looking through the different sort of peer groups that you guys have here on this infographic, the idea of low food insecurity with high resilience, high insecurity with high housing costs as well. I guess the ultimate message is that these things don't exist in a vacuum. These things kind of work together in many ways to create areas of food insecurity.
Exactly. So a lot of times when you look at some previous reports, they really focus in only on food insecurity, and they don't look at the multiple issues that may be working together either to create the condition of food insecurity or where families might have, they may be food insecure, but if they're also housing insecure, you really have to look at what are those root causes that might be driving both of those conditions, whether it be high unemployment, financial and economic health. So all of those things may be, they may co-occur or they may be driving the higher rates of food insecurity in a county.
I went ahead and plugged in Cook County. First of all, didn't know there were three Cook counties across the country. Went ahead and picked Cook County, Illinois, and comes up with a nice bright orange. Well, not so nice. High food insecurity with the highest housing costs, mostly urban. Break down what that means for Cook County.
So when you look at Cook County, as compared, of course, there were some counties that fell into that very high food insecurity with high housing costs. When you look at Cook County, we are a little lower than, let's say, some of those very, very high counties, but we still have a high rate. About 12% of residents that live in Cook County are food insecure. That means that they're concerned that they don't have reliable access to the sufficient quantity of affordable foods, that they fear that they're going to run out of food and not have money to purchase more. So it's mainly an economic condition when you think about the idea that a household might fear that they won't have the money to purchase more food. And it also can be a geographic aspect to that, where they may lack sufficient food access as well. So in Cook County, we have high food insecurity, so right around 12%, and then we also have people that need to or that are experiencing high housing costs. So high housing costs, or when people have to use their income for other basic needs, can also create a condition of food insecurity. And this is what this represents.
Similar areas, it's not just Cook County in the area. We've got Champaign County down south on Interstate 57, even closer than that, Kankakee County, then up near Rockford, Winnebago County. All right, so when I'm looking at these counties with these sort of categories, what are some things that you guys would advise or that local leaders can do to try and combat this?
I think the first thing is, what do we have when it comes to our normal food and nutrition system in the United States to help people that are food insecure? And the first defense is SNAP. So to make sure that we have adequate support for SNAP, that families are able to get access to SNAP. So part of that core food assistance, we think about the WIC program, which are which targets women that are pregnant, postpartum, infants, and children up to the age of 5. So to make sure that those programs stay strong and that people are able to access them. I think there's other strategies when we think about affordable housing. So if families are using a lot of their income to just get a roof, make sure that they have a roof over their head, then that can lead to excess costs that people can't use to purchase food or make sure that they have other basic needs met. So to really expand those strategies to create and preserve affordable housing and support families' ability to afford housing, so things like housing trust funds, to make sure that we have inclusionary zoning, and so expanding housing opportunities, ensuring that people can get access to housing assistance and removing barriers, as well as thinking about innovative programs that can combine food and housing, or that deal with root causes, because mm-hmm. really some of the root causes that affect food insecurity also, as I mentioned, affect housing insecurity.
Yeah.
So when we think about unemployment, we think access to assistance programs, yes, but also job training programs, making sure that we have a living wage in place so people can afford their basic needs.
Yeah.
Some groups are also at higher risk for food insecurity, so communities of color and immigrant populations. So if we look at this also with a racial equity lens, that some barriers, including things like structural racism and discrimination, may also impact families.
And certainly we're just beginning to scratch the surface of this conversation. Dr. Odom Jung, unfortunately we're out of time, but urban.org is where to go. It's right on the front page right now, disrupting food insecurity. Thanks so much for joining us here today.
Okay, thank you so much.
720 WGN, the Wintrust Business Lunch. John Hanson in for Steve Bertrand. We'll be here for the rest of the week till Friday. So I have always, you know, we talk about video games and are people addicted to them. And I got to admit, I usually roll my eyes when I hear something like that. It doesn't really compute with me, although I wasn't much of a gamer myself. But I think my mind has been changed. Ferris Jaber wrote an incredible article in the New York Times. Ferris, you're joining us on the line. Thanks for joining us here on the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Yes, thank you for having me.
You told the story of Charlie Brack, and it was the first time that I've ever really seen it laid out in a way that it's you replace the word gaming with drugs or with alcohol or whatever it may be, and this guy really was an addict, and I imagine there's plenty more like him.
Yeah, there's definitely a growing number of young men in particular and their parents, as well as clinicians and psychiatrists, who are really concerned about this problem.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is it nomenclature? Is it, you know, because it's about like trying to identify really what is an addict, and there's so many different kind of definitions depending on who you ask. So I guess let's start from the beginning. First of all, how'd you get meet up with Charlie and tell his story?
So I knew about the conversations in the academic literature surrounding gaming addiction and behavioral addictions for quite a while. And this May, the World Health Organization decided to officially add what they call gaming disorder to their clinical guidebook that's used around the world. And that was a pretty controversial decision because there are quite a few scientists and psychiatrists who don't think that it's that addiction is the right way to think about it. They think it might be, you know, there might be a better framework for thinking about it. But the WHO and the American Psychiatric Association think there is considerable evidence showing that this might be a real addiction. And Charlie is somebody who went to a rehab program in Washington State called Restart, which is really one of the only long-term dedicated programs for this problem in the United States. And he's kind of become an advocate for this issue and has shared his story pretty widely. And I got a chance to meet with him in Washington State and visit that rehab center and just talk to him, you know, many, many conversations, many, many hours, and just really opened up to me and shared a lot of details about his story.
As you were telling his story, there'd be moments where I thought, oh, yeah, this guy is definitely addicted and using the kind of the term as I know it to be. But then there's moments where you're like, is this guy just depressed and this is a symptom of that as a sort of outlet? I imagine that a lot of people go back and forth on that.
I think there's a lot of confusion about that. You know, one of the main arguments that critics of this idea make is that it's not a real addiction, it's just a symptom of a larger problem. But the truth is that with most addictions, whether they're drug addictions or behavioral addictions, they are, in fact, part of a larger psychosocial distress in that person's life. And that doesn't invalidate the addiction. And it's, in fact, extremely common for somebody to have both addiction and other mental health problems, such as depression or anxiety.
I imagine video game industry, since this is a business show, certainly this is not something they want, you know, to be codified in some sort of way in terms of labeling an addiction, just because it labels the industry in a bad light.
Right. And video games have already dealt with a lot of stigmas. You know, they're stereotyped as promoting slothfulness or violence or social ineptitude. And a lot of the leaders in the gaming industry worry that this official diagnosis will just further stigmatize video games.
The fact that these games are addicting is partially by design, right?
It is. If you look, I talk to some game developers and designers, and if you look on web forums that are dedicated to those kinds of subjects, you see that addictiveness is openly celebrated in the gaming industry. There's a lot of pressure on game designers and developers to make games as addictive as possible, and the industry does not shy away from using that word. And a lot of hardcore gamers will even sort of half-jokingly talk about games as being addictive and themselves being addicted as a good thing.
I imagine that a lot of the kind of trying to get over the stigma of this or trying to identify really what it is comes from a lot of people's personal experience, maybe themselves or with friends who play video games a lot, but still kind of live their everyday lives. And yeah, they're playing a lot, but they're still able to go about it. I guess it's sort of like what we talk about with other addictions, the idea of are they functioning through this sort of thing? There's some earlier stages to be seen. I guess like anyone, no addiction, no individual experience is like anyone else's.
Right, and that's an important point, is that we're not talking, at least not in North America and Europe, we're not talking about an epidemic or a major public health crisis. We're talking about a problem that afflicts a very small percentage of gamers, but it's still a real problem. And I think that's true for addictions in general. You know, most people who drink or try drugs are not going to become addicted for life. It's only a small percentage of people that develop these kinds of problems. But that doesn't mean that they're not real and that people who are going through this don't need professional treatment.
Ferris, I imagine you learned a lot writing this article.
Yeah, it took me many months to report and write, and I really tried to embed with some gamers, and yeah, I definitely learned a lot.
It's one of the better reads I've read in the last couple of weeks or months, and it needs a little bit more time than what we have today, unfortunately. Ferris, nice job on the article, and thanks so much for joining us here on the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thank you.
All right. Oh, man, we were just diving into the surface of that. But really, if you do have some chance, you can go to NewYorkTimes.com to pick it up. Or what I did, just Google, can you really be addicted to video games? Because that is the headline. 720 WGN, John Hanson in for Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm so excited to chat toys and the holiday season coming up. And what better person to have in here than the shopkeeper at Timeless Toys, Scott Freeland. Scott, how are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Gearing up for the season, I bet you are.
Oh, yeah. We're almost ready.
Yeah, exactly. Timeless Toys, Timeless Tots up in Lincoln Square, two great stores. Tell us a little bit about your business.
So Timeless Toys has been around for 25 years, and we're in Lincoln Square, and we focus on toys that are educational for children ages 0 to 12 and things that are going to last them a lifetime, things they could physically play with.
I got all my nieces and nephews' toys there last year. It's such a great little area to walk, do some shopping. We actually did all of our shopping for the family just in the Lincoln Square neighborhood, and I imagine that comes as no surprise to you.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, our neighborhood is filled with little local shops, and you can find everything you need there for the holiday season.
And I don't even live there. That's not even an endorsement there. I live a little bit further away. Okay, Scott, let's talk about the top toys for the season. Let's go by different age groups. You got kind of one for each sort of little age group here, right?
Absolutely. So I'll start with ages 0 to 3. My favorite toy for that age is going to be called Dina Toys.
Dina Toys. What
Dina
are those?
Dina Toys. So it is from France, and they Ooh. Are little silicone figures that come in rainbows of colors. And they are houses, little people, and trees. And they're good for multiple things. They're made of silicone, so you can teeth on them when you're little. You can use them for stacking, shape sorting, colors, color sorting. And since they're silicone, you could also use them for baking and use them to bake some fun-shaped cookies.
Learn some stuff along the way.
Absolutely.
As we go through these next toys, I want to point out one of the advantages to going to a shop like yours. Look, a lot of times, and I admit, before I visited your place, I would kind of just roam around a mall or kind of roam around a Target, and they have little numbers on there that tell you the ages, and you just kind of go by that. But, man, you're really doing it blind there as opposed to at your location. You could chat with someone, kind of learn a little bit more about why they're valuable.
Exactly. Our staff is all trained in early childhood development, child psychology, early education. So we're there not to help you find what the most popular toy is. We're there to help you find what's the right toy for the child you're shopping for. So we're going to ask you questions all about that child, get to know them a little bit, and we'll find something that's appropriate for them and not necessarily just what the age says on the box.
But we still love lists. So let's pick the
yes.
most popular toy, ages 4 to 6.
So my favorite toy for this year, ages 4 to 6, is axe throwing.
What?
Yes, it is amazing. So there's been axe throwing places opening up
yeah.
all over. We went to one as a staff for a holiday party.
A little bond to the party.
Had
okay.
so much fun. And this is a indoor axe throwing. It comes with these foam axes. It's all Velcro. Great for ages 4+, but wonderful for adults as well. And you could have a little axe throwing competition right there in your house.
I love that. And I have a nephew who just turned 4, and boy, he loves to throw. He loves the interactivity, and I think that that'll be perfect for him.
Yeah, it is great.
And no one gets hurt. That's the important thing.
Exactly.
It's not like lawn darts back when we were kids.
Exactly. Yeah, no, it's all safe, and it's perfect. Even if an axe hits your TV, it will still be fine.
That's good to know. Ages 7 and up, what is your
ages
favorite one?
Ages 7 and up. So personally, I love board games, and
yeah.
I love cooperative interactive games. So my favorite thing is called Heist. It is a game for up to 4 players where you're working together to break open a vault. And when you break it open, actual little gold bars fly out at you.
So sort of like an escape room, but on the board game for kids.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're working together as a team, and it's very fast-paced. So the game will tell you directions, and you have to follow those directions together as a team as the speed increases to be able to open the vault.
As someone who's running a toy shop, do you love when people bring in the kids to touch and to see? Is that cool?
I love when people bring in their kids. That's what we're there for. We don't want you to just come in and shop. Our store is an experience for your kids. We have toys out everywhere for them to play with. We will open pretty much anything in the store if you want to see it. Come in, come play, come find what you want and what drives you to play.
It makes a great environment, but it's really hard to drag a toy out of a kid's hand. So, you know, it's a little sales piece there, too.
Oh, absolutely. Actually, parents always apologize to us when their kid leaves kicking and screaming. We take it as a badge of honor. If your kid leaves willingly, we didn't do our job
yeah,
right.
Yeah, there you go. You know? New It toy for Christmas. What are you thinking?
So our It toy, I think, for this Christmas, it's not a big thing. It's a stocking stuffer, really.
Okay.
And it's Nido. Nido is a little stress ball. It comes in probably 10 to 15 different styles. It's got different textures, different colors. It glows in the dark. It changes colors. If you are looking for some stress relief or just something to fidget with, this is the best fidget toy of all time. I think everyone should have one on their desk at work, and every kid should have one in their backpack.
So aged 3+, you mean 3 to 99 to 100, whatever
Absolutely.
You need.
Absolutely,
right.
Yes.
Retro toys always in, and what do you got here on the list for the top ones this year?
Retro toys are the best back new this year, again, is Speak and Spell. I don't know if you remember Speak and Spell.
Now I'm trying to picture it. Is it like a yellow box or a red box? And it has a little display board, right?
Yeah, and it will randomly creep you out by speaking in the middle of the night to you.
Okay, now I'm remembering.
It is back. We also have some handheld games like Tetris, Pac-Man. Oregon Trail is in a handheld game now. Rock'em Sock'em Robots. And brand new back this year is Tonka Metal Trucks again.
Oh, yeah.
And Pretty Pretty Princess, the 90s board game, is back in.
Now, when we say retro games, we're not meaning these are old traded in. These are actually newly created retro flashbacks, okay?
Yes, absolutely. Things that went out of print, went out of style, and are now being remade.
Okay, that's pretty cool. Some upcoming events. You got one coming up here soon.
Yeah, so coming up November 9th is Neighborhood Toy Store Day. No matter where you are in the country or where you are in Chicago, you can go celebrate your neighborhood toy store. Everyone is celebrating. Us at Timeless Toys, we're going to have some raffles, and we're going to be demoing some toys. So come in, come play, and it's a chance for us to celebrate your local neighborhood toy store.
We also have a preview and influencer night. What are those for those kids that play toys on YouTube? Is that what it's for? No?
I wish not. this is mostly going to be for some of our VIPs in an influencer event. We're going to have some local Illinois toy makers and game makers coming in, and they're going to show their products. It'll be kind of a holiday sneak preview. Come in, have some drinks and food, shop without the kids, and get some good holiday shopping.
And whether it's Timeless Toys, Timeless Tots, or any of the other businesses in Lincoln Square, Small Business Saturday on the November 30th. A good reminder for everyone to shop local.
Yes, Small Business Saturday is coming up at Timeless Toys and Timeless Tots. The first 50 customers to come in and purchase a gift of $50 or more will get a free $25 gift card to use in store.
Pretty good stuff. Remind us of the addresses, where everyone can go if people don't know.
So we are located at 4749 North Lincoln Avenue in Lincoln Square, and you could also see us at timelesstoys.com or timelesstoyschicago.com.
I think the toy place you got up there is great. I think it's a destination for people also from the suburbs, and while you're there, you're going to be able to shop for the whole family. Seriously, the neighborhood, if you haven't walked through Lincoln Square in a while, it's gorgeous, it's great, it's even better around the holidays, and I was never had a problem finding parking. That's always been everyone's worry. Scott, thanks so much for stopping by.
Yeah, thanks for having us, and make sure to look in your mailbox for our catalog that will be coming to you soon.
There you go. Timeless Toys, Timeless Tots up in Lincoln Square. Time for the Wintrust Business Minute on WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. Here's a saying to remember: when it rains, it pours. That's probably what many thought when they heard marijuana legalization was coming to Illinois.
First it's this drug, next it's every drug.
A group of Illinois City Council members are pushing for the decriminalization of magic mushrooms. Now, this isn't just for the opportunity to start popping psychedelic fungi on a Thursday. Their justification is to use the drug for more research on opioid alternatives. There's been research done on it before that targeted PTSD, headaches, and more. But I think many would agree that we should take baby steps towards this thing. And it looks like that's the approach Krispy Kreme is taking on the donut wars that's consumed our breakfast lives. The donut company opened their first location in Chicago since 2005, and it's in the Pedway right below Block 37, one of the busiest spots in the city. It's a cozy little shop with 1,000 square feet, so only enough space for a couple of tables. Red and Blue Line riders are at the highest risk of getting caught in that sweet trap, so stay sharp, people. You might just end up walking into work with a dozen donuts, which is a good and a bad thing. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
720 WGN, John Hanson here for Steve Bertrand, wrapping up the Wintrust Business Lunch. Not before we talk about getting a credit card with a retail store. And I promise, my good friend Nathan Grant, I am excited to chat with you, despite the fact that I just hung up the phone and Bennett had to scramble and get you back on. Sorry about that.
No worries.
All right. So a lot of people, you know, when they go to the retail store, I've done this too. You're buying something big and then they say, well, if you open up a credit card today, you're going to get X amount off. And I say, you know what? That just did it for me. I'm going to do it. A survey shows that maybe not as many people are happy with those decisions after they're done with them.
Yeah. So, you know, usually it's incentives like that, you know, a discount off of something, either your first purchase or an ongoing discount at that retailer if it's something you frequent regularly. And, you know, a lot of times the stores are pushing their employees to kind of hit sign up goals too. So there's, you know, it's easy to fall into that and think, hey, you know what, why not? But we recently at Credit Card Insider did a survey of just under 4,000 people to find out about their retail store card habits. And believe it or not, over 40% of the respondents actually revealed they regretted applying applying for the retail card in the first place. So that was kind of the first wake-up call. It's like, whoa, maybe this isn't the right decision at the right time.
Yeah, and I imagine a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, people do it. They think they're going to pay it off on time before they accrue that interest. It turns out otherwise. And then the discount that they got just gets negated.
Yeah, I mean, here's how you can look at it is any credit card, even if it has a higher interest rate, which in general, retail store credit cards are often in the 25 to 30% range, so they are a little higher. But any credit card, if you pay it off responsibly and have your statement paid down month to month, the interest rate doesn't even become a factor. So if you're a responsible card user, then you're good to go. But what does happen is a lot of times people sign up for, let's say, a 0% introductory APR offer. And sometimes those can have a period of up to like a year that you could pay off the amount. So for like holiday balances and stuff, hey, if you feel like you can pay it off within that time, that actually might be a good idea for you to use that, get a discount, and then you'll have it paid off by the time it's due. But if you don't, a lot of times in the fine print with a lot of these retail store cards, they will mention deferred interest. And that sounds good because it sounds like, oh, good, the interest is being pushed way down. But if you make just one late payment, or if you reach the end of that period, even if it is a year later, and before the period's over with, or right when the period's over with, there's even just a dollar left on there, you could be charged interest for the entire initial balance, interest on that total balance from the beginning. So it's very important that you know going in when you get a card, all the terms, all the specifics, because then you don't want to get caught in a situation like that where you're like, oh, no. So it's very, very, very tricky when it comes to retail store cards.
I have one deferred interest card on a laptop I bought, and it makes me nervous to make sure that the auto payment is going through and that my calculations are correct. I'm just about to just pay it off because it makes me so nervous. Really quickly, a percentage of cardholders that indicate that the discount was the reason they got the card. What's the number?
Yeah, so we had, let's see, 85% said that they applied for it in store, usually was because of the discount or rewards on the first day.
That's
so not even the ongoing thing. And with any credit card decision or any major financial decision, you wanna make those decisions at the checkout line or, you know, somewhere like that. You want to have these planned out beforehand. So it could be a helpful tool for the holidays,
and,
you know, if it's a place you go regularly. But if you don't plan ahead, you could catch yourself in a situation where it's, you know, coming back and biting you in the future. So I'd be very careful with it.
Big thanks to Nathan Grant, analyst at Credit Card Insider.